On this week's show, ethical roadblocks hindering the widespread adoption of AI. With Ritwik Bhatbayal from MassTech, we're going to skip the news because this is the news this week.
Construction is the world's oldest industry but spends the least amount of money on innovation. When we realized people outside the construction industry didn't typically associate construction with technology like virtual reality, apps, and robotics, we started the ConTech Crew. Each week, we bring our listeners the latest in ConTech news and interview the minds behind the technological innovations changing the way we build. So strap in, enjoy the ride, and geek out. It's ConTech Crew time.
All right. Y'all will notice that it is just me sitting down with Ritwik. This is a special episode, folks. You know, haven't been under a rock. You know, there's this new thing out there called AI. And it's small. Nobody really cares about it. It doesn't do a lot. I'm kidding. It's actually been pretty powerful. But I think in our industry and construction, we've been in a little bubble. So Ritwik and his team reached out from MassTech and offered up their expertise. They have a global kind of view. So I'm sitting down with Ritwik today. Ritwik, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
So can you give everybody a little background on who you are, maybe a little bit about MassTech before we reach into, you know, AI and its impacts?
Firstly, I'd like to say about my company. MassTech is an IT solutions and services company headquartered in India. It provides a range of services in digital transformation, IT consulting, system integration across the industries, specifically focusing on government sectors, healthcare, and financial sectors. It has been founded in 1982. It focuses on quite complex enterprise level solutions and digital transformations with some specific focal areas in cloud transformation, with Oracle and Salesforce being the specialist sector. If I would have to call the digital transformation, it kind of ranges from the legacy systems to the technology transformation that we normally face. The agile consulting, which is very much ingrained in most of the services that we offer, the data side of not just the modernization, but the analytics that associated with it. The cloud services I already touched upon, the key platforms and the specialized areas that we have, and definitely the application development, maintenance, and the massive cost advantage that we bring on with our experts into this area. Though we have a very long tail of accounts, wherein we run a shared service delivery too. Now, we, as a company, we are spread worldwide with a presence at North America, Europe, UK, and Asia Pacific. Coming down to my profile, I have around 27 years of experience, you know, primarily starting with the corporate, it would be the areas of digital developments, mainframes, and then moving on to my entrepreneurial journey into some of the key areas of API. You know, at that time it was OSGA bundle, and then into some of the business sectors of automobile. And after my entrepreneurial journey, you know, both of my few companies got acquired. My second company got acquired by an MNC, wherein I came on to head the technologies and the engineering part of the company, more having the outcome-based services of that company. From there, I moved on to bring in an after-sales support, how it can be productized over engineering asset. And then from there, I joined MassTech, pretty much, you know, with the idea of setting up a massive incubation engine out here. And you can always feel that when something like that gets set up at a particular corporate, you know, the two technologies that come and get baked in are IoT and AI. So that's the basic background of mine. You know, I still code during my off time and during the night times when my normal daytime gets over. But that keeps me very much as a practitioner more than just the research and the business part of it.
Construction in general is a highly stressful environment, and you see the stress, and you always get the "I'm fine" answer, but always try to dig a little deeper because people say, you know, I haven't been sleeping great, and I'm really eating crappy food, and I feel anxious, I feel depressed, I feel, you know, we'll start to really get into those conversations and figure out what's going on. There's some great resources, and if you go to brentdarnell.com/resources, first, there's an emotional intelligence and physical symptoms survey test. So we get your emotional profile and we get your physical profile based on physical symptoms, and we tell how your body's working. And then we can correlate those two. And if burnout, if you're experiencing burnout, it will show up in probably both of those evaluations. It's free. You just download it and do it. And just so see where you are. And if burnout's the top two or three that pop up and show up there, I would pay attention. And start to really look at what are you doing with stress and nutrition and sleep and exercise and daily reflection and those kinds of things that we know we need to do to keep us healthy and keep us sane and keep us on track.
You've got to check in with where you are. You've got to work on balancing. It's not about the diagnosis. It's about preventing people from getting too far down the road. Like most of our construction folks that listen in, they take care of their cars. They keep them up to date. You know, this is no different. You've got to put in the maintenance on the body, on the mind, because you're racing this car around the track, right? We're not going to change that we're a bunch of race cars out there, but we can change that we do the right maintenance, take the right time, and really check in.
One more resource in there, the Tough Guy Survival Kit, guy being gender neutral. It's specifically written geared toward more field folks, but there's a really great chapter on stress management and peak performance in there. And it talks about meditation techniques and mindfulness techniques and breathing techniques.
Yeah. So you hit on a couple of great things there. A lot of what we bring and hear about in construction, even though it's a worldwide, on this show, it's usually very focused on North America. So it's great to bring in the outside experience. And also what you're talking about is something that I think goes far beyond what most construction companies in North America really experience. When you talk about the level of integration, when you talk about the amount of data, moving to things like Oracle and moving to things like Salesforce, those are heavy lifts with a lot of change management, with a lot of process management, with a lot of improvement. So you guys have created skills over the years to sort of handle that. But you've also, since you code at night, which I love because, you know, that shows the passion, right? And we all move through our careers and somewhat become less practitioners, more researchers, leaders, those types of things. But it's great to stay on top of it. So specifically, what I wanted to focus you in on, and one of the things that was so great to bring you on the show for, was, you know, the AI is seen as a new phenomenon. But in our initial talks, and now you mentioned that this has been going on for a long time before. Can you talk about sort of how you've been preparing, what MasTec and the other companies before this helped prepare you for, and what you were seeing? And we'll get to kind of where we are today.
Jeff, I think, you know, the foundation to some of the points that you just now mentioned has always been data, and, you know, not just that. I think most of the other companies were doing a bit of data modernization in various capacities. Data modernization includes cleansing, transformation, extraction, and then loading of that data into a structure from where businesses can tap out when. Now, every project that we, from the service providers we used to anchor, used to go this site. At varying capacities, the data modernization, you know, which included all of the key ending blocks that I was stating, had finesse brought in from experts, from companies, to either consultation, to either advisory, or probably the implementation ability. But give or take, you know, that was not really disrupting the space. It was always going in a step-by-step model. And people were all okay about it because, you know, once the data modernization happened, you know, the analytics slowly crept in. And that's where the churning of that modernized data were kind of getting rendered to the dashboard, to the single pane of glass, so that people can actually make a meaning of. And this making of a meaning is always memory. It is always left to the experience quotient of the audience, of the people who are seeing. It's all about that. Slowly there was a movement that started happening in the early 2000s when machine learning crept in. And what I was talking about, the human being weaning out of that analyzed data, suddenly started moving to a point of an extra set of additional intelligence, I would call, which were added onto the data that is rendered onto the screen. That had its own maturizations. You know, it moved on from various models, and there are products that facilitated doing. It kept on moving. Another 10 years, if we fast track, you know, we started getting to see that it's not just about the data rendering part, where a good amount of machine learning and the transformation was happening through intelligence all the way. Started having a big play at the back end, where data at rest coming in, you know, most. And at that level, we used to run certain things called deep learning. And this is where the neural networks, the convolutional neural networks, and the various other models started creeping in, you know. And these models started coming in. The data scientists started playing a big, big role in putting across those models, firstly going through the setup steps of taking the data, cleansing it, and then putting those formulas and equations and getting the models right. If you really dig deep into that, these data scientists were hard to get. You know, it's a skill set which in its true form was doing a great job of really transforming the back-end data address. You know, some of it also started coming into the front-end too. And the whole exercise seemingly was quite complicated. It's not something which is as fluid and as easy to use like the software side. You know, softwares, we used to consume the most of that data and process. But this data science part of it had really a science baked in, you know, along with the equations. The equations were not something that were kind of picked up from a list. It was being weighed on top of real data. It just so happened in 2020 plus, when ChatGPT hit us, you know, I think things got seen. The whole concept of data and, you know, scientists, or probably the human participation at the design level, suddenly moved, you know, became intelligently automated, if I could coin that word. And the entire backend deep learning, I again probably reiterate that, the entire backend deep learning concept is has just got disrupted. You know, it went into a way wherein it's not just about text, it's not just about PDFs, it's also about some of those key steps that we so long were thinking that it can only be done by human. For example, a developer wants to code, program through proper codes in a particular language. And it is always, we knew that it's a function of experience, it's a function of skill set, and then only a person or, you know, would be able to code that. And the moment this ChatGPT came in, we found that it's getting coded. If we give a problem statement, which is like plain textual business lingo, basis that the coding happens. And my focus area is not just about the coding. Those, you know, for a developer, because I do develop, you know, there is a build-up that happens for development. which is where we run the problem statement in our mind. We design it either on a piece of paper or in our mind, and then slowly translate that into little component blocks, which we try to materialize through codes. Now, these 4-5 steps are very much a function of experience, function of skill set, function of real abilities that are so non-human. Now, suddenly we see that thing happening in a near perfect way by the Gen AI or the GPTs and so on and so forth. So I think that's the movement that we see. And again, if we take a few steps back and see this entire journey of 2000, then 2010, and then 2020 or 21, we see this disruption kicking in, 2020 or 21 in that manner. So I'll probably pause over there and say, this is what I have seen, and this is what is kicking in to really transform or take this kind of disruption in the business scenarios, and I'm sure in the construction industry that is also coming in quite heavily.
Yeah, I mean, we're coming in behind on the data, and it's interesting because I think the AI, kind of revolution, so to speak, that's going on right now has actually driven some of the construction companies. This is what we've been trying to teach, is back to what I think a lot of those industries you're talking about were sort of painstakingly doing before, in taking the process of cleansing the data, moving the data, cleaning it up, and then getting it into a place that you could do deep learning, that you could do analytics, that you could get real information or at least insights into what you want to do. I love that you continue to talk about, the human quotient involved in making decisions, and even that this might be taking, and we used to talk about needing a data scientist. So this is talking about how maybe some of that is being amplified. That was a hard position to get. So great to see that that's helping it. What I want to look forward to is, now that you've done such a good job of setting the stage, there's this inherent, I don't know if it's a need or just what we want to do, but we always want to just push because the technology can. We want to move forward and go fast. But there's some things that you're really concerned about that I don't think we talk about enough. So first, there's this thing about bias in algorithms that I don't think it's talked about enough. If you step back, and my listeners will know this, we used to talk about this on the crew when it comes to coding. Anybody who develops software, exactly like you said, right? We picture it in our heads. We do these things. We naturally have biases. I don't want people to think that that's some sort of specific racial bias or whatever bias. It's just a bias of our own view. We only know what we know. So we are inherently coding that in. And because there's been ways over the years for us to code and sort of get some of that out, it's going to be much more difficult. We need to think about it. So talk a little bit about how you're thinking about that in AI right now, and what that even means to you when it comes to, all the ways that you have to look at building an algorithm.
I think we need to all be a little cognizant that with every disruption, there are these kind of controls that kind of gives us an opportunity to handle, because it's a disruption. A disruption cannot just like that come, which is of a very clean and perfect path. It will have those control, I would call them as controls in the world of manufacturing, yes, do that, which are very much needed to ensure that we remain on that. Now, coming straight to the response to your query, I'll probably break up the response into key blocks. The first being what you said as bias or probably discrimination. I think when the foundation of something like this for analytics or machine learning, deep learning, and moving on to Gen AI, where the start point has been data, there is a big element of inheriting biases to the training data, leading to possibly the discriminatory outcomes that, in critical areas such as, let's say, the law enforcement or various other blocks, it can happen. I was just noticing certain examples in facial recognition, you know, which is, you know, in fact, I was working with one of the solution providers in the jewelry space, and they have this facial recognition based identification of individuals, and that's because, you know, the whole industry of jewelry e-commerce is based on trust. So they brought in this this facial recognition based identification, and then kind of getting into a customer. Now, this facial recognition block, you know, by bringing in this AI component to it, it has a very interesting thing coming up. That is, anyone who is dark skin, you know, the error rate of identifying that very strangely was coming up to 34-35% of error rate than the light skin, you know, people, which is like 0.5 to less than 1%. Now, essentially, when something like this happens, you know, it is all coming from the noise elements. You know, if I go into the details of a face understanding through an AI model, it is all about the noise understanding, capture, and then removal of that. And, you know, it's called, there are models to it, I can piece it, and using those models, it actually clears off and creates kind of a sample size against which the actual picture gets compared.
Back in 2020, I heard about a new software platform called Join. Within minutes of seeing Join, I knew it had the power to revolutionize collaborative project delivery. In fact, I was so sold on Join that I joined the team as its industry evangelist. Many trade shows and podcasts later, Join is now used by 50% of the ENR top 30. Why? Pre-con and ops leaders at DPR, Bolt, McCarthy, Barton Mallow, Clark, and others say that they like Join because it does two big things: collaborative, trackable decision-making, and awesomely simple visuals. Want to learn more about the power of Join? Go to www.join.build/demo to learn about how better gets built.
So the image identification and image recognition happens. Now, coming back, that's the kind of data which, because it was not handled, it is going to a point of discrimination. It is going to a point of bias. I will come to the second point of privacy. You know, the data that gets collected, processed, analyzed, and these are vast amounts of data where the personal information also comes into play, you know, for identifying the persona of an individual or probably working out the you know, while doing personalization, while increasing the engagement quotient, which is very, very important in today's business or tomorrow's business. And for that, personalization is very important. Personalization is basically a function of personal information. And personal information, you know, the moment it starts increasing in size, the stringent privacy concerns come into play. Unless and until we govern that, we ensure that the accessibility, the sensitive information guardrails, you know, isn't there, the concerns with respect to privacy will always become very important. And that is, you know, a very important area to face in today's GenAI or tomorrow's AI implementation. Then comes the accountability and responsibility. You know, like, who is accountable for an AI-driven decision? It's not really very well defined in sectors like criminal justice or healthcare, you know, where AI decisions can have profound impact. The lack of clear accountability can really hinder the adoption of AI because it's machine-driven. End of the day, it's a system outcome the accountability always is a question. It's no one single throat to choke or one single point to go to and get that thing properly analyzed. The element of a potential legal and ethical impact is quite high. The element of transparency and explainability, many AI systems, particularly those using the deep learning, you know, act as black boxes. So how the decisions are made over there, what are those connections of dots that are happening at the back is definitely, questionable from the clarity perspective. And that's what is very important. And if the transparency is in question, the trust component in every human's mind will take a beating. And without trust, any business transaction is only percentage completed. So I think that transparency and explainability is always an important area to look to. Finally, I would probably say another key building block or roadblock in this space is the fear of job loss, the aspect of inequality and social unrest that can come up if this whole concept of job loss come in. And I have a complete research element that is there, again, getting information from multiple places, that tomorrow's business or execution will not be just job-based. A job will finally be broken down into tasks, and it is at that level tasks will get identified which can be automated, which can be intelligently automated, and which cannot be. Because that's where probably the differentiation between a human-driven activity and automation-driven activity will be defined and established. And if we can do that thing better, I think we'll be able to handle this situation better. If we just always remain at the job level and feel that somehow, you know, somebody is going to take care, I think we get into more issues. So the more deeper, more detailed, more grander we become, I think the better governance it will fetch us. I think these are the key roadblocks that, in my view, is going to come up.
I think that's great, Ritwik, because you hit on a number of different things. Transparency and trust is something we've talked about in business consistently. Construction is a relationship business. The interesting thing is the data, the technology has gotten in the way of that relationship over time because it's not giving us clarity. It's not giving us those things. And it's not going to do that in AI if we're not understanding the technology. So I really like the facial recognition example that you gave there is that it wasn't the model, if we peel back, was probably not trained enough on dark skin people and understanding the depth at which of diversity we're going to have coming onto our sites. That's going to be really interesting for construction because we're going to see construction use more and more technology like this to identify things on job sites. And we got to go back to, you could see dark-skinned people having a failure rate is a pretty easy thing to catch, right, in the end. What are the things we're not catching if we're not paying close enough attention? Those are the ones, that's why we bring up things like, the facial recognition and matching, because there's a need for us not to just trust this black box completely. There's a need to lean in, learn more, understand more. So if you're a leader at a construction company and you're thinking about all this technology and what you should be focused on, these are the questions you should be asking. Ritwik and his team go out. They have a lot of those answers. But a lot of the time, Ritwik is there asking the question. So you as the leader need to ask those same questions. So I love that framing. And then you hit a couple of other things, but I'm going to jump to the end here. And I want to talk about this a little bit more because I think you nailed something I'm going to use going forward is we're going to look at jobs and we're going to look at tasks and we're going to look at how they're built and we're going to automate out the tasks that can be intelligently done by a machine, and we're going to amplify the human effect. And to construction, if you're listening, that means, and Ritwick, you might not know these things, but an RFI, a pay app, a change order, a design question, those types of things, those will be automated in the information passing back and forth and being captured and understood. The conversation, the intent will be focused on by the human. What a machine can't do is understand what a client wants out of their particular hospital or their lab, right? Only humans having a conversation, building a relationship can do that. And if we automate out more tasks, we lift up humans to do what they do really, really well. So I'm interested in where maybe from outside of our sector, not thinking construction, but just thinking where you have the purview, some of the places you're already seeing that. So maybe our construction folks can model it.
Before I get to that point, I think you made a very good point, which can be a segue to another very interesting example. Generative AI might not recognize the concept of gender and may struggle to understand who it interacts with every time the user inputs a query. So it may suddenly switch gender pronouns. You know, for example, you know, someone who states his or he preferences by she or her or they. And now this reduces the feeling of personalization, which is so, so important for making that connect, you know, which is very important for a relationship building. So in areas where we have the relationship taking a center stage, I think, you know, that is something that definitely is a function that needs to be handled by human, or much more a kind of a persona that can ensure some of these key checks and balances. What, again, if we take the same interaction aspect to a routine or to a kind of a routine sector or customer service sector, which is just handling products, purchase and service, that is where some of these elements can be intelligently automated. But where relationship is a primary focus, things like understanding the expectation and then getting to the details of it, it is better left to the human abilities to handle. I mean, just to say on that part. Now, coming to some of the other parts that we are seeing, how Gen AI modeling can really help. I think in the world, every job gets broken down into tasks, and at the task level, some of these definitions or some of these usages come to a better need. Though there is no stereotype framework for using AI or Gen AI for every such task, understand when somebody sits down with us to architect, to solve it. But at a broader level, if we have to really take, understand or identify, I think the key thing is an element of learning or getting educated, getting a jump start about what AI can do, what AI cannot do, or probably is not the right space to implement AI. And that's where personalized, adaptive learning experiences or learning programs are getting crafted at a breathtaking pace in UDemy and some of those cases that I have seen. And I think those are very important for the community to go through, understand, and then get the initial homework done to get to the broader solution. There are elements of government-funded design or the training programs
that are there, which needs to be aligned to. There are skill certification programs that are there. So some of these, I would say, training experience are very much a precursor to solve these scenarios that we see happening, to break down or to identify the tasks of a complete job where AI can be applied and where AI is not the right thing to do.
This is what's interesting to me, is because, again, we always look at new technology as some sort of panacea, right? It's just going to take care of it. It's just going to do it. It's never that way. It always takes training. It always takes learning. And it always takes organizations going through evolution to learn how to properly apply tools and train their people to identify it. Like you said, right now, if I go out into the world, everybody tells me there's an AI answer to everything I want. And really, a lot of times, I just need another, I need a form of some sort. I need some technology that already exists. I need something that's a part of a system that I already have. I don't need to go reinvent the wheel. So I like that you hit on that, and that organizations themselves need to mature and train their people in order to learn how to identify and break those tasks down, and then how to then apply, the models that might exist, the tools that might exist that are based on those models. I think lastly, what I really want you to do is, if you and when you sit down with leaders, you're working on their industry, you're working on their company, how are you encouraging them to get involved in what's going on and make sure they're having the right impact? Because again, at the leadership level, it's not about picks and clicks. Those are things you do after hours. It's about research. It's about guidance. It's about leadership. So what advice can you give on the way out to a leader listening in on how to take some steps forward in, say, the next 6 months around their organization and around AI and the industry itself?
I probably approach it in phases. I think, the best way to handle some of these big changes, which are not very frequent, to handle this in a step-by-step manner, mostly what I see now, it's like companies have really gone ahead and there is a big rush to innovate and gain market share or market advantage, by getting into Gen AI and AI in a not so thoughtful way. And the issue with that is it can really, really overshadow the roadblocks that I was talking about on the ethical side, on the problem side, which can suddenly crop up if we don't take a very thoughtful approach on this. And since the leaders, since the companies are more on quarter by quarter, they have this sudden focus that we have to do something to really gain the market advantage, has shown a massive dip in market share, and their numbers have come down. So their whole proposition, they wanted to make it a bit AI-ish. And I'm sure, they have taken note about it. And they are again coming back to their existing workflow. It's a workflow product company. And they are again coming to their forte and trying to see how they can harden or tighten the nuts and bolts over there in their business, than just like that going into the AI way of doing. Second point is the elements of AI adoption is a multidisciplinary kind of, it's a function of multidisciplinary participation. It's not just a single line of action. It has to have participation from all the players, all the departments, to ensure that there is a proper adoption going on. One is definitely on the technology, but the other areas that assures the rightful adoption and application are going to come from legal, from finance, from marketing, from delivery, and all those areas which are going to play an important role to make sure that this is properly implemented. And third, the regulatory frameworks which which would be very important to create that broader framework in which this would get applied and this would probably get executed. Now, when we have these kind of key principles which will act as a guardrail for a rightful implementation, I think, again, it comes or boils down to a proper understanding and learning or training of using these principles in the first place or using AI, find it. And that's where incentivization of learning or this kind of an education whereby the company should introduce subsidies, tax incentives for the individuals to do or to get invested into a continuous education or skill development is going to be so important. The skill certification programs I have already touched upon, it's again going to be quite important to ensure that the right upskilling initiatives are in place. And there is also another important thing, which is where the companies need to work or participate, they need to work people, those common groups along with public sector or the government initiatives on the regulatory framework creation, the ethical standard books or policy controls creation. Again, with government identifying the fair competition elements that every player has a role to play, every player, the equitable participation for every player, big or small, along with government, has to be there. Then only there is a good governance that comes into play. More inclusive policies that need to be set up. That's my second block of how internalizing and externalizing or creating a framework of this collaboration between internal upskilling and external framework compliance comes into play. I have already touched upon the key areas to focus, which normally one needs to go through as the three first steps that I said. Finally, I will say, coming to clearly the technology side of it, that there are two blocks of adopting such a disruptive technology. One is consumption model, and the other is customization model. In consumption for a GenAI, it's like, using the APIs, using the LLMs, and to prompt tuning or prefix learning, there are ways and means of doing it very, very specifically, very correctly. That is one way of using it. And the customization is like the basic foundation models. And there are lots of foundation models which are coming up. Why? How to tune them so that they are made very specific to the domain area or to the business area where the solution is being done. So that's how I'll probably end my response to this pointer that he said, Jeff.
Ritwik, thank you so much. You really unpacked a lot in a short period of time. I know the listeners are going to have a lot to listen to. I know I have some thoughts to formulate it. So I just want to thank you for sitting down with me today. Let people know if they want to learn more about MassTech or you, where they might be able to go to learn that.
Sure. Thank you. I'd be happy to help participate and definitely along with our company. We have a particular approach to that, Jeff. And I believe every problem resolution starts with a consultative participation wherein we dissect and slice the business or the problem area of that business very specific to the discussion point, and then bring in technology, bring in solutions and more. So technology comes as an enabler at a second or third level. But understanding the problem scenario is something that MassTech excels. And I'm part of that. I'll definitely be along with my company. Be happy to help you know that.
Awesome. Well, thank you today. And thank you for tuning in today to Geek Out for our interview with Ritwik Bhatbayal. To read all our news stories, to learn more about our guests, and to listen to this show, visit thecontechcrew.com. This is The Contech Crew signing out. Until next time, enjoy the ride and geek out.